This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak Show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Rupert Murdoch at a bar mitzvah. We're talking to our very special guest right here. She's a published author, an eloquent activist, a human rights advocate, working tirelessly for the people of Palestine all the way from Malaysia. We are talking tonight to Norma Hashim. Welcome to the People Speak Show, Norma, ma'am.
Hello. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is there. It's the morning here. I'm glad to be on the show. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's fantastic to have you here. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you tonight is, how did you first get started in being involved in researching the Palestinian situation?
Well, it started in actually 2008 when Israel launched an extremely brutal attack on Gaza, and I think that woke the world up. I think many people were not aware of the Palestinian issue before that, and I wasn't actually, I have to admit. But when we see the pictures in the newspapers and the media, it was quite horrific. In that time, it was called Operation Castlet by the Israelis, and they bombed Israel, they bombed Gaza for 3 weeks nonstop, and it killed 1,400 people in Gaza. And there was no regard for civilians, for children, for sick people, because their hospitals, schools, mosques, UN buildings even were bombed, and people were just killed inside and flattened. Ambulances were fired upon, ambulance drivers were killed. So it was something horrific to all of us. And here in Malaysia, my sister and her friends actually decided to start something like do fundraising to get some relief over there. And they called me in because I'm an accountant by training. So they wanted someone to manage the funds. So from someone who had no idea about the Palestinian issue, I was like dragged into it. and this was in 2009, early 2009. So, you know, once I was inside and because I was dealing with funds and I was sending money over, I had to get really involved to make sure that things went to the right places. And some of my colleagues had gone to Gaza as well. So we had to audit the projects. And that's how I got so involved that now I speak to a Palestinian every day, and we're still doing a lot of projects now. Yeah.
Well, since getting started in Viva Palestina Malaysia, which is the group you're actively involved in, you've actually written two books which are detailing some of the stories and the diaries of the prisoners in Palestine. We'll start with the prisoners' diaries. Can you tell us a little bit more about that book?
Well, yes. One of the projects we did was with the Center for CPDS, Center for Political and Development Studies. And at one stage, they said to me that they felt that they needed to have a library in English language. And I thought it was a great idea. So I worked with them, with my family, to provide some funding to start the Hashim Sani Library in Gaza. It's still the only social science library in English. And I felt it was an important project to do a library in Gaza, because for many years, the Western media had only heard the Israeli Zionist version of the situation. And we had to change the narrative. We had to bring Palestinian voices inside, especially to the West, to let them know the other side of the story. So I felt it was so important to teach young Palestinians to write, read and write in English. So that's where we started off. And the center now at the library, we still have classes in creative writing. We teach young people to blog. So I think we're getting there now. You know, Palestinian voices, young people are speaking out a lot more nowadays. So what happened was, due to my involvement in the library, one of the directors in the library wrote to me, and he was a journalist, and he had a team of young journalists with him. And in 2012, he sent me a bundle of transcripts of interviews that they had done with prisoners who had been released. In 2011, there was a swap. There was one soldier called Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier who had been kidnapped, and they couldn't find him for 5 years. In the end, there was an agreement to exchange 1,027 Palestinian prisoners with one soldier. That was how valuable it was to the Israelis. And when these Palestinian prisoners, when they came out, we call them political prisoners, by the way, because it's a political situation. They were interviewed. Most of them could not really speak and did not want to speak, but there were 38 of them who actually shared some of their feelings and their stories with the journalists. So this was what was written down, and it was translated by Yusuf and Raed, two young translators who were working at the library, translators, and they sent it to me. And I read these stories, and they were incredibly moving. At a point, at first, I thought that I wasn't the right person to publish a book. They asked me to get these stories out to the world, basically, because we on the outside don't understand the situation with imprisonment that affects the Palestinians. In fact, about 800,000 Palestinians have been arrested, have been imprisoned since 1967. So basically, every family, every Palestinian family has had someone, a relative, a neighbor, or a friend who has been in prison. So it affects them very closely, something very close to them, prisoners, and they're regarded as heroes as well. And the thing is, we on the outside, we have no idea about this because it doesn't affect us at all. So when I read these stories, I first thought that, you know, maybe they should find someone else who's into, you know, writing, who's involved in media, because, you know, I'm an accountant. But then after a couple of months, I went back to them and said, do you have any luck in getting these stories published? And they said no. And I felt so sad because, to me, these were very important stories. I mean, they humanize the prisoners. Instead of just being statistics, they showed them that as people like us, very human. And I felt that it was so important to let people know this side of the Palestinian issue. And if I can actually read a bit from the book to let you know how it was. Yeah, the prisoners were so close to the children. What in the book, the stories they tell is not about what they've done, but about how much they miss the people they loved. And it was exactly how we would feel if we were separated from our loved ones. This person, his name was Iyad Obayat, for instance, and he was sentenced to 3 life sentences because that's how they do it in Israel. For every offense, you get 1 life sentence. If you kill 3 people, you get 3 life sentences. So he was sent away for a very long time. And he talked about his journal that he kept all the time. It was a diary he kept, which was very precious to him. And he would say that my children were growing up little by little. After they visited me, I would quietly write down everything new about them in my journal. I used to draw their pictures. How did they look when they came? And when they left, what did we talk about? How many times did they laugh? How many times did they cry? I mean, these are the things that affected them the most. And another person who would say that when he was suffering in prison, when he had nightmares, his name was Ibrahim Al-Masri. He said, the photo of my 2 daughters gave me the power to bear my life in the prison and the cruelty of the jailer. It kept my heart beating day by day, despite the daily death the prison imposed upon inmates. You know, when you read this, you realize this are just people like us. People, we have children, and we would feel the same way. And another last story, I want to read a bit of it. Rauhi Mushtaha was also away, sentenced to 24 years, and he had left his bride of 6 months behind. And then when the journalist asked him to describe what his experience of in prison, he described only the last night before he was released. And he spoke as if he was speaking to his wife. He wrote, one night separates me from you. Why won't it end? Is it my eagerness to see a woman who entered my life for only 6 months? When you were left grasping for patience, she practiced patience beyond what you could imagine. So, you know, it is a person who loved his wife so much and he told his wife to divorce him because he was going to be away a long time, but still she kept waiting, and she waited for 24 years till he was released. So, you know, these are wonderful experiences. I mean, a kind of happy ending in the end that they were released, you see. But also, we know that there are so many more prisoners now still in prison. In fact, the number of prisoners have gone up. There are now 7,000 prisoners in Israeli jails. 15 of them are serving sentences of over 25 years. And and among these prisoners, almost 400 are children, which led to my next book. You know,
well, after reading the first book, The Prisoner Diaries, one thing that really struck me is a lot of these people have been traumatized very, very badly. That the treatment that they get in prison is beyond what any human being, normal human being, could endure. Do you see that a lot of these people are traumatized when they're released?
Yes, yes. In fact, because, you know, of 1,000 prisoners, they could only get about 38 of them to speak. That was all. A lot of people don't want to speak about it. People also don't want to admit they are prisoners sometimes because, you know, they want to forget the whole thing, the experiences. And there's, you know, to lack of funding, there's also very little support for prisoners, and a lot of them are traumatized and they should get support. But so there is a kind of prisoners club. That's where we go also to get some more information on the former prisoners as well. But that all they give is maybe a bit of help. They know where to find another person to talk to maybe, but there's no professional help. And they also need, of course, financial help. So a lot of them do suffer even after they come out from prison. Yes.
And I understand, too, that a lot of these people in prison are there on false charges, that Israel regularly kidnaps people and creates and fabricates charges. Is that true?
Yes, even for the children. I mean, a lot of them are in prison for no reason, accused of, but without witnesses, and they're sentenced nonetheless. And, of course, there are things like this whole system, which is extremely cruel. It's designed to break up the community and the feeling of camaraderie as well, which is people are forced to spy on their neighbors and their friends and their family. And they're forced to spy on threat of injury, on threat of being put in prison themselves. And so a lot of them will tell. There was one of the stories, in fact, a person said that when he was arrested in the middle of the night, a person, a Palestinian, was with the soldiers, and he was like covered up. You couldn't see who it was, but he pointed out this person to him. So they get people to pinpoint another person. Maybe the person is falsely accused because the person who's accusing is trying to escape imprisonment himself. You see, it's a vicious system. Yes. And inside prison also, there's horrible incidences of torture. They are forced to confess, and they are tortured psychologically and physically. In one case of one of the stories here, this lady called Sana Shihada, yes, and they tried to make her confess to something and she refused, and they couldn't break her. So what they did was they sent bulldozers to her parents' home and they made her listen on the phone until she could hear her parents shouting and screaming because they could see the bulldozers coming to demolish the house. You know, but in the story, she says her mother, when she knew that her daughter was on the phone listening, the mother shouted out to her, "Don't confess." You know, they are very resilient people. They're willing to withstand anything. Yes. And the reason they do this is for the love of their homeland. They don't give up. The spirit, the resilience that they have. I mean, this is why the Palestinians are still around, still resisting the occupation after 70 years, you know? Yeah.
That there's one thing I always believe, that if we give up on the Palestinians, then we give up on ourselves. To support them is to support humanity and human rights in all of its forms. If we do not support the Palestinian human rights, we basically have lost our own human rights. Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. It's a human rights issue. And the thing is, like for now, like for instance, now Aleppo is under siege, and the whole world is horrified that these are people under siege being bombed. But they forget that Gaza is under siege. since 2006. I mean, it's 10 years they've been under siege. There's no access. We can't go in. They can't go out. Students lost scholarships. And, you know, during the attacks on Gaza in 2008, in 2012, in 2014, all the times that Israel has attacked Gaza, they were under siege and the people could not escape. So they had to stay put inside when they were being bombed. I mean, a million tons of explosives was dropped on Gaza during the attacks in 2008, for instance. And the people just sat there waiting for death, not knowing if they were the next one to be killed. So I was on the phone one time in 2012 with my friend in Gaza, and it was the time of the attacks as well. And he said to me, good night, sister. I'm not sure if I'll be able to speak to you tomorrow because we don't know what's going to happen to us tonight. You know, and it just killed me, really. You know, it broke my heart thinking that here was my friend and he had no place to run. You know, in Gaza, there are no bunkers. When the Israelis drop their bombs, where would they run? So you don't know whether you'll be the next one because you have no idea. And you can't run because your land is under siege. What do you do? I mean, I think the American people don't know that these weapons are funded by taxpayers in America, you know? And oh, these are people under siege, and they were killed under siege, like it's happening now in Aleppo. But they have endured this since 2006, you know?
Now, your first book, The Prisoner Diaries, was published in 2013. Can you tell me what kind of response have you had worldwide from people listening to you and publishing your book and actually buying your book? Because people can buy that online. What sort of response have you had from that?
Actually, it's amazing because, to be honest, I published the books first time. I self-published it because I didn't really want people to interfere with it. You know, sometimes when you send it to a publisher, they do a lot of stuff with it. And I didn't really want the story to be affected in any way. But also because when I did go also to a local publisher here, they said, oh, I don't know whether people want to read, you know, books about prisoners. And I felt a bit upset. So I decided to self-publish it. And I didn't expect, I didn't know what to expect, really. But it was more like, I wanted to give the dignity of the prisoners to them. These stories belong to them and they should be told. I wanted them published for posterity. So I just did it for that reason, for the love of Palestine and the prisoners and the situation there as well that we needed to end. So then what happened was people started picking it up and there were such good reviews of the book as well. I was surprised and maybe I should have expected it, but I didn't realize there was so much empathy and support for the Palestinians and for the prisoners. So what happened was we're now in six languages already. We had the English one first, and then of course we subsequently did the Arabic one. And then one day I got an email from a French surgeon. He had gone to Gaza and someone had given him my book. And he said he read it in one night. He went to Gaza to do operations on children. He was an orthopedic surgeon. When he went back to Paris, he emailed me and said that he wanted to get it translated, and he arranged everything. He got a professional translator, and so now we ended up with a French version of the book. And then we also have an Indonesian one, which an NGO published. And when I read the translation, because I can understand Indonesian, it was fantastic. When people do this pro bono out the love of the cause and of the people, the book becomes really good. The Turkish translation was done by my friend who's blind, because I work with blind people as well in another NGO. And it just happened when I mentioned to him, he wanted to read it. So I sent him the text, you know, in a Word file. And when he read it, he said he was moved to tears. And he took it upon himself also to translate it, a blind person translating it. He had a friend who was sighted, and she edited the book. She had a degree in literature. And then I actually gave a copy to President Erdogan a couple of years back. So we're now in six languages already. And coincidentally, yesterday, an Iranian person met me. He had contacted me and said he picked up the book and he was so moved by it as well, because he had an uncle who had been in prison in Lebanon. And he also felt very close to this book. And he started translating into Persian So inshallah, by next early next year, we'll have a Persian translation done. You know, so that will be number 7.
Mm.
So it's inshallah. Quite amazing. Yes. So that's pretty amazing. And I think we've sold maybe about 10,000 books around the world. The reception has been good. I do hope everyone reads this book. It's actually so important. It's so important because it's such a human book. It tells you of people who suffer fighting for their land. And I think a lot of people now will understand that feeling. The feeling of dispossession, people stealing your land. What it feels like to lose the place you live in, have no place to go to, you know? I think people like the Syrians now, the Aborigines, displaced people, the Rohingyas, everyone has this common thing of being dispossessed. So a lot of people will identify with the book. It will show you how far people will go. They were willing to go to prison, to go under torture, to resist this occupation of their land. I wanted to point out also that, as mentioned by Richard Falk in his review last time, he said that, in World War II, when the Europeans were resisting the German occupation and in their criminal practices, we glorified the resistance fighters. But now, when the occupier is someone that's an ally of the US, we then criminalize the resistance, you know? We have to think about this. Why we do this? Why the double standards? Because this book cuts through this kind of thing, and it lets you experience the torment of these prisoners as human beings, rather than as like soldiers or terrorists, as Israel likes to paint them. Yeah.
Now your work with Palestine and Malaysia has taken you to many different countries, and you recently got back from Sydney, Australia. What other places have you been to, and what kind of reception have you got going there?
I traveled to, mostly I traveled to UK. That's a very good Palestine Solidarity Campaign. A lot of events going on there. In fact, I'm planning to launch my book, the new one called Dreaming of Freedom, which is about Palestinian child prisoners. Can I speak a bit about the book now?
Yes, please do. That was released in June of this year. Is that correct? Or July this year?
July this year, we released Dreaming of Freedom. What happened was after 3 years, Yusuf and I, Yusuf the translator originally for the first book, we decided that the issue of child prisoners was something so important and so critical that it had to be brought further up into the consciousness of the world. In fact, yesterday, a very famous case now, I think a lot of this is on social media, about the case of the boy, 13-year-old boy called Ahmad Manasra, who with his cousin was shot at. His cousin was killed last year, and he was accused of attempting to stab a soldier. Attempting because no one was injured, and it was there was no other evidence. And the thing with Ahmad was, when he was 13 years old, and there was a video of him on the ground. He had been run over by a settler and beaten up, and they were tormenting him and saying that you should die. And the thing is, in Israel, children, Palestinians, are held under military law. And children, Palestinian children, every year, 500, 700 of them, are persecuted in military courts. Which other country in the world does this? And so this boy called Ahmad Manasra, he was 13 years old. Now, the law says that you have to be 14. And when you're 14 years old, a Palestinian child can be tried as an adult. So they kept him. They kept him, he was 13, but they kept him in a center until he was 14. And when he turned 14, they brought him to trial. And this is what happened. And yesterday, they sentenced him to 12 years, almost as long as his life. 12 years in prison, he's got ahead of him. And then many other children who have been sentenced to 10 years, in many, many years in prison. And they're very young. I mean, actually, the thing with why I did the book also is because I have children this age, and I could not imagine what it feels like to be a mother in Palestine, knowing that your child at this age, where you're about 12, 13, 14, your boy, you are so vulnerable, and you don't have the protection of even the Convention for Child Rights, for the rights of a child. I mean, these are the things that should protect it. It's an international convention. But the UN, it says that children should not be tortured. They should not be detained for no reason. they should not be restrained or they should not be questioned without a lawyer or without their parents. But all these things are happening in Israel, in Palestine, you know, happening to the children there. So the case of Ahmad Manasra being sentenced to 12 years at the age of 14 when he had allegedly committed the offence at 13. And then the case of another one, the Haris boys, the five boys, accused of throwing stones without witnesses, and at the time they were 15 years old, and now they're sentenced to 15 years in jail. You know, their whole life ahead of them is destroyed. I mean, what they've lost their schooling, their education, the chance to go to school. What happens to these kids in prison, you know? So really, as parents and people who care, all of us, this is something we should all rise up against. There should be an international outcry against what happens to Palestinian children. In Sydney, I have a friend in Sydney, in fact, she's Palestinian, and she was doing her PhD, and she's supposed to go back now to the West Bank, but she has a son who's 14, and she has valuable work to do in the West Bank as a lawyer. But she can't bring herself to return because she's afraid of her only son. What lies ahead for him as a boy of 14, a Palestinian, under occupation? You know, this is a very real fear of all parents, and it should not happen. And really, it's terrible. The torture that children go through, if you read the book, because we got, when Yusuf and I decided to do the book on child prisoners, we got someone to interview them in the West Bank. She herself, her husband was in prison. So the stories that came out were just incredible. It was just dreadful. It was horrible. And I sat on the stories for a few months. I just could not go on, really. It was dreadful, like this person, this boy who's 15. He says that he was arrested with his friends. They were brought to interrogation inside a room. An interrogator entered the room carrying something in his hand. He plugged it to the wall, to a wire. His friend started screaming. He was being electrocuted by something. And he said even after his release, his friend's screams are stuck in his mind. And every time he remembered it, he'd close his eyes and he would cry in his heart. You know, these are things that happen to children in prison, in Israel, an ally of America, and funded by tax dollars. I think the public needs to know that.
And the Zionist dollars keep rolling on. They never seem to stop.
$38 billion. I mean, now they've got $38 billion secured for the next 10 years. And these are weapons. They use it to create new weapons. And they test it, like Jeff Halper says. Gaza has become the testing ground of new weapons. And after that, when they've been tested to show that, oh, white phosphorus, cluster bombs or bunker bombs that go right deep inside, and they know it works. And then other countries buy them because they've been tested on people. How bad is that? How wicked is that? Really, isn't it?
These big corporations like the Carlyle Group and a bunch of others like Combined Systems Incorporated, they're making profits of selling these things to Israel. And really, these are the companies we should avoid and we should let other people know about.
That's right. In fact, we should always encourage now, as we feel as citizens, maybe we feel that we're powerless because we're not in the government, but always the voice of the people counts in the end, right? You know, because exactly. We can do many things. We can vote in politicians who will not be slaves to this to Israel and its policies, and we can also practice boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Boycott companies that profit from the occupation. You can choose a company. If you do a bit of research, you'll find many companies that make money under this occupation, like G4S. They secure the prisons that keep the children in, and they give the equipment that used to torture the people. Yeah, I mean, there are many companies you can look at. You can divest. You can protest. HP Hewlett-Packard provides military. They provide all the technology that the military uses and the Navy. Yeah.
There's other companies like Nestle, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Starbucks, Caterpillar. The list of companies that support Israel just go on and on and on, and it seems overwhelming. But we as consumers, we can make the choice to either stop giving money to these companies. Is that correct?
Yes, we can. Everyone can do a bit of research and decide which one they want to boycott. Sometimes maybe you think, oh, I can't do anything about G4S, you know, because it's like a big corporation and I'm not involved in this or something. But you can always boycott HP. Caterpillar actually redesigned its tractors, I think, to demolish houses in Palestine. You know, what they used to demolish Palestinian homes, and these are homes that you know, settlers can build as they wish. And settlers, there are illegal settlements in Palestine, in the West Bank. Yet, when the Palestinian builds or repairs his home, he can't get approval. And so the Caterpillar tractors are sent in, Hyundai as well. And these Caterpillars are modified so that they can be used to demolish houses. That's how bad it is. That's how bad these corporations are, you know.
Well, please do stick with us, Ms. Hashim. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson. We're talking with very special guest, Mrs. Norma Hashim, live on Internet Radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
You're listening to the People Speak Show, coming to you live across America and across the world in real time on the BBS Radio Network. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with a very special guest, Mrs. Norma Hashim, the vigilant Palestinian rights activist. I encourage all the listeners to visit her website at www.vpm.org.my from Malaysia. Welcome back there, Norma, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Nice talking to you.
Yes. After reading your books, one gets the feeling that while reading the situation is simply overwhelming, however, realizing that these are direct personal accounts of people who have suffered this and lived, it also says there's a lot of hope and positivity also. Were you affected personally in such a way while you were editing the books that you published? Were you affected emotionally?
Yes, I was, because the first book, which is The Prisoner's Diaries, which has 22 stories of prisoners, men and women. The women were mothers, and the men were married and they had children. You could identify with them as a human being. You could identify if you yourself had been forced to, maybe by work or whatever, to be away from your children. You'd be thinking about them all the time. You'd be thinking what they were doing. And then you'd be thinking about, you miss them a lot. So the prisoners feel the same. And sometimes it's worse, right? Because they can't touch the children sometimes. They can't hold their hands because they are always separated by a glass a wall, you see. And there was one of the stories, actually, which I actually got personally from another Palestinian friend of mine. He had visited Malaysia, and I was saying to him, I was doing this book on prisoners. He says, oh, yeah, my cousin was in prison for 24 years. I said, really? And he said, yeah, I mean, when he was 20, I think he was arrested. And for 16 years, every time he saw his mother and his father, he was behind a glass wall. And one day, the prison authorities said, oh, okay, you know that if your parents have reached 70, you can actually take a photo with them. And he was so excited. This what happened a year before his father turned 70. His father was 69. So he waited a year. And the day that his parents came, and then the guard said, okay, you can go in through the door now. His father was horrified and shocked. I mean, he didn't expect this. And his father fainted. You know, it was like, for me, I felt it was like so emotional. And until this day, the man said he was released. His name is Abdurrahman. He said he never shows the parents that photo that they took when they were together at last, because it would bring back very painful memories for his parents, you know. I felt that. And especially when I did the children's book, I was traumatized because these were kids as young as 11. One of them was 11 years old. And he was tortured. He's beaten. He was forced to crawl on the ground all the way from his home to the truck in his village, you know, the military truck waiting for him. They forced him to crawl on his knees. And so much cruelty to very young children. And the whole process of intimidation, of being beaten up, kept in solitary. Imagine young children, your kids, age 12, 13, kept in a little cell, barely bigger than the mattress itself on the floor. And then they don't switch off the light. They leave the bulb on. So there's a very disturbing light on the whole time. And then the prison cell is full of bugs, like cockroaches or something. Very dirty, very smelly. Can you imagine a child of 12 having to stay in a cell like that alone, not seeing his mother maybe for 3 months? What kind of people do this to children, you know? So I was quite traumatized. And when reading it, I felt I didn't want to go on. And then I had to pull myself together and say, I have to make this into a book that people want to read. So this is how I started working on this, to kind of get photos of the children. So from the initial first interview with the kids, we followed up on what happened to them. We got photos of them. Of course, we got their permission. We went through the prisoners' club in the West Bank to make sure that it was all right and they didn't mind being interviewed, so that they don't know that people aren't learning about their story. A lot of them are proud to tell their stories, in fact. But the tragic thing is that one of the boys in the interview, called Ayman Abbasi, he was killed after that, before we could publish the book. Because you know that there's currently like an intifada now in Palestine. The first intifada was in 1987. It's called the Stones Intifada. It was a time when, if you can remember, the images of children throwing stones at tanks.
Yes.
And that was the first one. And then there was a second intifada that happened when Ariel Sharon had gone into Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's a very provocative move. And that led to an uprising. People protested that he had gone into the mosque and he shouldn't have. It was a deliberate attempt to make them angry, I think. So currently there's another uprising now, which is mostly done by children. Many children now have been killed. In fact, I think over 50 children have been killed since last October by the Israeli soldiers. And some of them are entirely random. There are kids walking to school, and because they are boys, and this is why I explained that my friend, the lawyer in Sydney, who's supposed to go back to West Bank, she's tormented by the thought that her son, who's 14, would have to live through an occupation like that. Boys walking to school in school bags, just shot dead by a sniper. Nobody's held accountable. 57 children killed, boys and girls. And in cases, sometimes they seem to have planted a knife beside the body after the person's killed. There's no other evidence to show that the person had tried to stab anybody. But the fact is that there are still 57 children who have been killed since October last year, in 1 year. I mean, these are kids. So what's really going on? I mean, it's terrible. So the book had to come out. And I'm glad it came out at the time it did, because the situation is getting worse and worse. In the last just a few days, children have been sentenced to 6 years, 15 years, 12 years in prison. it's not getting better, it's getting worse. So this is a time when people really need to speak up to the government, to their MPs, and petition everyone, the UN, any human rights groups, to rise up against this and stop Israel from continuing this dreadful practices.
I mean, you know, I've seen online on your Facebook page for Malaysia, Viva Palestinian Malaysia, I've seen online some of the donations and the help that Malaysia Free Palestina have done for the people, not only in the West Bank, but in Gaza, which is simply incredible. An amazing amount of goods and donated stuff from the people of Malaysia. Is there really that much support for Palestine coming from Malaysia itself?
Well, there are different kinds of activism now because, you know, I have friends who are activists all around the world, and I do see different countries have a different approach. In the U.S., maybe I think people, they don't give maybe so much, but they are more active in protesting in front of HP, in front of G4S, like my friends over there. I see them in England as well. They have regular protests in front of G4S in London. I've been there as well. In Malaysia, people maybe they are more generous. They are very generous. In fact, because I'm the treasurer for Viva Palestina Malaysia, I oversee all the projects. And yesterday, for instance, yesterday I was looking through the bank statement because I was trying to do a reconciliation with our cash book and the bank statement. And I saw the donations coming in. And we had people donating $5 every week. A person was donating $5 a week from her pay probably. And it was one person who gave $50,000. To me, all donors are important. Everyone has to sacrifice to give a bit of money. Or a lot of money. So I'm really touched by the support that we get. We do a lot of projects. We try to be very transparent. We are accountable for everything. And we're all volunteers. I don't get paid. In fact, none of us get paid except we do have a part-time staff. And we employ someone, an engineer working part-time for us as well in Gaza. He oversees all our projects. And because he's an engineer, they tend to be good at project management. So he's very good at giving feedback, and we get photos sent to us. So yeah, we try to use anything we receive well in the way that we think the donor would want to use it. Recently, we started a project, in fact, in Syria. A lot of people feel helpless about helping in Syria, but we have someone there who works. We have an NGO there that we've worked with for a long time. And we also work with the Palestinian Red Crescent. And what we've done this last 2 years is we send in milk supplies to children under siege. As you know, Yarmouk camp near Damascus is under siege. And so the people can't come out now because ISIS has infiltrated a lot of the camp. So the people are stuck inside because the government of Syria has surrounded the camp. But with permission from the government, they allow us to bring in milk and medicines. So that is one project which I'm proud that we're able to do, which is extremely useful because in Yarmouk camp, which used to be a hub of about 1 million people, they're now down to just a few thousand. Many people have been killed or they escaped. And the people now who are left there, they can't leave or they don't want to leave because they feel that's the only home they have. But many of them cannot leave for medical treatment. Doctors have been killed. Hospitals have been flattened already. So what we do is we send in a mobile clinic once a month with doctors from the Red Crescent. And they provide services for heart disease, for children, for women. So all sorts of specialists come in once a month to treat them. And we give them free medicine. And children especially, we give them milk because... otherwise, you know, there's no water, there's no electricity, then very little supply of food. So we give them milk and vitamins. That's one project. That's the latest project we are working on.
Fantastic.
In Gaza, we are still rebuilding. As you know, after the attacks, especially 2014, it's just incredible how many people, tens of thousands of people have been left homeless. And you know, with the siege of Gaza, it means that cement cannot come in. People cannot rebuild. But things are smuggled through tunnels or people can get some stuff across at very high price. So what we do is we try to repair homes with patching up windows and, you know, doing little things. We can't properly rebuild a home, but we can provide some repairs to shield them for winter. And this is what we're doing now. We're going to start again because winter is coming. So we're going to restart this project of providing them shelter for winter. A lot of people are still living outside the rubble of their homes. Yeah.
We do have a caller. We've got Mike from California on line one. Are you there, Mike? Go ahead.
Yes, I am. Norma, it's a pleasure listening to you, an honor, actually. I noticed you're using the pronoun we, as if, you know, you are a Palestinian.
I didn't realize that.
No, I find that the empathy, you know, you're so involved in it. And my question was, is the average Malaysian aware of, and perhaps even sympathetic to, the people of Palestine? Because as an American, here in the United States, where everything is so pro-Israel, the average American thinks of Palestinians as bomb-carrying terrorists and the Israelis as victims. You know, I don't know. Just that's, you know, is the media as, is it leaning towards the Palestinians in Malaysia? You know, why is Malaysia, or are you the exception? Are you an exceptional?
Oh, no. No, there are many Malaysians. I'm really blessed to be in a country where many, many people are pro-Palestinian. Our media is it's pro-Palestinian because, you know, Malaysia doesn't have ties with Israel from years back already. And our government doesn't have ties. I know there is some trade probably because of technology, but it's not really acknowledged. So basically, people here are pro-Palestinian, but they're very generous. I wish we were more active and more vocal on the world front. Because I think maybe Malaysians are not a very vocal kind of people, you know, like the Americans, like the British people. But they are very generous, and that has helped tremendously to deliver relief where needed. Because in the end, you know, there was an American folk singer, Joan Baez. She said, action is the antidote to despair, right? So basically for me, you feel despair, you see bombs falling down on Gaza, you feel you see people homeless, people crippled. So we have to take action. So I'm glad with the donations that we receive, we can take action to provide relief for the people in as many ways possible. But one of my favorite projects now is empowerment of the people. I don't feel that we should be firefighting all the time, giving relief, food aid, although we do that, medical aid. We have to move one step forward. We have to let the Palestinians learn to be independent. And one of the projects that we do, which is important, is called microfinancing. We give small loans to women especially to let them start their own projects. In Gaza, they are forced to buy products from Israel because of the siege. So only Israeli products are allowed, and they're forced to buy biscuits and things made in Israel. We try to provide funding for women, for people to start little businesses like bakeries, tailoring shops, mini markets, mobile phone shops, even animal husbandry like raising chickens and lambs, so that they can start being self-sustaining and they can afford to send their kids to school and university without relying on foreign aid, you know? Yeah.
Norma, you know, I've heard so many pro-Palestinian activists and guests on this show, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu. You know, I mean, there are, but none of them speak with the kind of activism. You're actually over there doing this. When you talk about microfinancing and, you know, directed towards the Palestinian people themselves to empower them, I mean, none of the guests ever talk about things like that. They focus on trying to get the word out that they're oppressed, but you're actually over there doing something.
Thank you. Because I don't know, maybe because I'm a mother of kids and I always make sure that things get done. You know, I can't just talk. Talk is cheap, really, isn't it?
Norma, I have one other question before you go. Are there others like you in other countries as well besides Malaysia? Are you forming a network where this, not just Malaysia, but your neighbors and others you come with in contact internationally, are they supporting you guys?
Yeah.
Are you guys growing?
Yes. When we do relief work, we have so many partners abroad. I mean, when we started a physical rehab center where we provide therapy for disabled people, and we had ambulances donated from New Zealand from an organization called Kia Ora Gaza. My friend there, Roger, he's fantastic. They raised money and we used it to buy ambulances, and these ambulances are used to carry the patients to the treatment at the center. Yes, we do definitely work with them, and the center's doctors are from funded by us, trained by Turkey. Turkey has an organization called Doctors Worldwide, and so they have the section where they train the doctors and nurses so that they can provide treatment for the disabled. Yes, definitely, we do work with people around the world. We have a great network as well in Australia, when I was in Sydney. We try to also share things like share speakers, because, you know, we are so far away from America that, say, if we get a speaker coming here from the US, like we had Ali Abu Nima, Miko Pellet, we try to share the costs between Malaysia and Australia and New Zealand so that they can speak at all these places, you know. There's a lot of cooperation. I'm very happy to meet with people involved in the course. And you know what, Mike? Are you there?
Yeah.
You know, everyone who is involved in this sincerely are really nice people. I can't tell you how wonderful the people are when you speak to them, activists from around the world, when they have a common cause. And you wouldn't do this for money, for glory. You do this for the love of Palestinians and for the love of humanity. So that's why you meet the best people, really.
Norma, I hope you come back and bring your friends as well. We need to hear from more people like you who are out there doing this. I mean, this is just inspiring. It's, you know, you've laid down a template for others to follow. Thank you.
Oh,
bravo.
Thank you. Anyone can do that, I think, yeah.
Thanks very much for your call there, Mike, and your questions.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you.
It certainly is fantastic, the positive work that you're doing, not just helping out with food and that, but you're actually getting them to get on their own two feet. And I think what Mike is saying is that nobody else is doing that. Nobody else is looking at it from that perspective. That's really, really unique. Have you had much support from other groups around the world who have taken on that idea of making the Palestinians self-sufficient?
I think there are other NGOs in Malaysia that we work with also who are pro-Palestinian that also do similar projects. Malaysians, I'm trying to think of others. I'm sure there are. Just that maybe because I'm not there in Gaza. And Gaza is a big place. It's got 2 million people now. So there must be other projects running. Maybe with the UN. I think the UN would also be doing maybe something like this, microfinancing or microcredit. They would do. It's just for me because... Actually, I can't say I'm special in any way because anything I do can be done by anybody, really. Really, I'm sure.
Yeah, but nobody's got the inspiration. Nobody's got the passion to do it like you're doing it.
Oh, well, I think I do it because I can do it. And I think that, you know, life is short. You know, I had a friend from school who passed away from cancer a couple of years back, and he brought it home to me as well that, you know, we don't know how long we have to live on this earth. We should make full use of it every minute we have, really. You know, don't waste time.
have you had any hard time for doing the work that you're doing, maybe from Israelis or anybody who's a Zionist supporter? Have you had any threats or anything like that?
No, thank God, no, because maybe I managed to shield myself from that kind of thing. I do find if people give me bad vibes, I just steer clear of them. You know, we got to stay positive. And so I think I can always find friends in every country I visit. That's a great thing. Like when I was going to Sydney, I was just looked up a Palestinian NGO and I made good friends through this, you know. Yeah, you can find very positive people in every country. In Italy, I met someone as well. It's great. I think I enjoy the work and it makes me feel good about myself as well, I have to admit. And giving to people actually helps you more than helps them sometimes, isn't it? You know?
I do believe you're not just helping the Palestinians, but you're shortly going to Indonesia to give canes to blind kids in Indonesia. Is that correct?
Well, no. Canes to blind kids I'm doing here next week in Malaysia. In Indonesia, we're actually visiting a school for the blind because I also have, I work with the blind worldwide. And actually at the moment, I'm actually working on trying to build a school for the blind in Somalia.
Wow.
We also send books to Nigeria. I also have an interest. I have lots of blind friends. Does that sound? Yeah, because I'm just also interested because it started like with the books on the prisoners. I love reading. I love books, and it struck me one day I met a blind person years ago, and I thought that how unfair is that I can read anything I want and he can't. So now I started this NGO. We produce books in Braille. You know, I don't have to do that much work because we do have two staff who are blind. We mm-hmm. employ people who are blind. We do get donations. People are generous, alhamdulillah. And so next week, I'm taking one of our blind staff with me to Jakarta to visit a school for the blind, because Indonesia, they're really quite advanced in how they teach the blind. And we just want to know how they do things. So it's like open our eyes, just to see how people do things in other countries. Yeah. Yes.
Right, right. What plans do you have coming up for the future? Do you have any more books that you're planning to publish?
No, actually now, like I mentioned yesterday, this Iranian person who is a student here, in fact, he's translating the book into Persian. So I will work with him on that new translation of the book, give him the photos, give him updates. I think we can update some of the stories. The other thing, sorry, what was your question again? What?
Do you have any future books published, or what are your plans coming up for the future?
The books can be translated further because, you know, the latest one called Dreaming of Freedom, a person in India, an NGO, in fact, they're just starting out BDS in New Delhi. Can you imagine? He contacted me. And you know, all the best people you meet are doing this work. So he actually has printed this book in India. He's working on, I think it's Hindi or Urdu translation of Dreaming of Freedom as well. And he's already printed an Indian edition of Dreaming of Freedom because he felt it's important, and I let him do it. If anyone listening would like to translate the books, I'd be happy, because this is advocacy, this is awareness. It's not mm-hmm. for profit. Any profit I make in each country where the book is sold, it goes to the NGO that is selling the book so that they can promote their cause. In the UK, my book is published by the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And any profits, the royalties they make from the book, I don't take it. I let them take it because they do advocacy work for prisoners there and for issues related to prisoners, including Palestinians. So I'm happy to let anyone translate the book in any language right. they need to, Spanish or whatever. You know, so that more people know about this issue around the world. I'm really happy to share whatever I can with anyone who's interested. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes. And we have a Facebook site for the books. It's called The Prisoner's Diaries. We have a webpage called Prisoner's Diaries, theprisonersdiaries.net. So you can also go on it and you can contact me through there if anyone wants to know more about the books or maybe about the projects that Viva Palestina Malaysia runs. Yeah.
Have you ever been to Gaza yourself personally, or do you ever have plans to go there?
Actually, many of my colleagues, Viva Palestina Malaysia, many of them have been to Gaza from the first time they did a convoy in 2008, in fact, yes. But I haven't been because the first time when they all went, my children were very young, and I didn't know how long I was going to be away, because, you know, when you go on a convoy with a siege on, you didn't know how long you're going to be stuck outside waiting, whether you could go in. Things were very uncertain, and it wouldn't have been fair to my children if I was away for an undetermined period of time. So now when they've grown up a bit, I want to go, but Gaza is under siege, you know? So I can't go, but the moment that I can go, inshallah, I will. I do want to see the projects and how they turned out. But, you know, with the internet now, it's like how we did the book Dreaming of Freedom. There were three of us. Yusuf was in Gaza and I was in Malaysia. And Faiha, the journalist, was in the West Bank. None of us could meet each other. You know, a person in Gaza couldn't come out. And Gaza is separated by Israel in between the West Bank and Gaza. So none of us could meet each other. But with internet, with Skype, we could get the book done. You know, we could get feedback and we could contact reporters. We got photographs. We got updates on the kids. And I was also working with people in the UK. Someone in England actually helped me to edit the book in terms of text, an English guy who was with the coalition Freedom Flotilla that sent the book to Gaza recently. So he helped me with the book. A lot of people helped me with the book, really. And Richard Falk in America, I mean, he's the one that wrote the foreword to the book. So with the internet, anything's possible.
Absolutely.
You know?
We are definitely going to have to get you on again to get an update very, very soon to find out how it's been going. But I'm afraid we're almost out of time.
Thanks very much for being on the show today.
Thanks very much.
Fantastic. I'm so glad you invited me. I'm glad to be able to speak to the American people.
It's been awesome. You can visit her website at www.vpm.org.my or www.theprisonersdiaries.blogspot.com. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Miss Norma, ma'am.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Steve. Yes. Nice speaking to you.
Stay tuned right here on BBS Radio, coming up very, very soon with special guests Doug and Donald Newsom coming up on this People Speak show. Big thanks today go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, to the room admins, Earthplay, Orangutan, Love is Light, and to all my friends throughout all the world and all the guys that give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.